enjoying the momentary flicker of doubt in the Xenos's eyes. "Go with your Emperor, Commissar Kane. You have our gratitude," he said at last, and followed his friends inside. The gates began to swing closed. "Time we were gone," I said, hoisting myself back into the cab. Castine decided to ride on the back this time. Can't say I blamed her after getting the full benefit of Jürgen, so I suggested the wounded trooper Penlan rode back in the cab with us instead. "Better safe than sorry," I said, "until we get back to the Medicaid, at least." So, despite her understandable reluctance, I was able to replace my human shield and enhance my reputation for concern about the troopers under my command at the same time. And we'd succeeded in doing our bit to prevent a full-scale war from breaking out, which was no mean feat. So, all in all, I could have been forgiven for feeling a little smug as we made our way back to our own staging area. So why, instead, did I keep thinking about the PDF troopers we'd been forced to kill, and wondering whose plans we'd derailed by their sacrifice? Chapter 7. The gratitude of the powerful is a heavy weight to bear. Gilbran Quayle, Collected Essays. Dawn broke at last across the wounded city, columns of smoke cracking the porcelain blue of the sky above the compound as the sun rose higher and ceased to echo the glow from the scattered fires, and my mood remained foul all morning. To my relief, we'd managed to make it back without having to shoot anyone else, apart from a couple of looters who'd been so high on some vicious local pharmaceutical they hadn't even realized the truck they were trying to hijack was full of armed soldiers until after they were dead. And all I wanted was a few hours' sleep. I'd been so pumped full of adrenaline since the assassin's gun went off that when I finally got the chance to relax, I collapsed like a puppet with its strings cut. And even Jürgen's appearance with a fresh pot of Tanner tea hadn't been enough to revive me. Nevertheless, I made my report to Brigade Headquarters as quickly as I could, reasoning that the sooner the whole sorry mess was someone else's problem, the better. And after an hour or so of paperwork, crawled away to my bunk with strict orders that I wasn't to be disturbed for anything short of a summons from the Emperor himself. In the event, I got about an hour's sleep before the next best thing. "Frack off!" I shouted, after the knocking on my door had finally become loud and insistent enough to wake me, and had gone on for long enough to convince me that it wasn't going to stop unless I responded in some way. "I'm sorry to disturb you, Commissar." Brocklaw's head appeared round the doorframe, looking remarkably free of regret. "But I'm afraid I can't. There are some people wanting to see you." Tired as I was, I knew there was no point in arguing. The mere fact that it was an officer of his rank rousting me out instead of Jürgen or some other lowly trooper told me that. I yawned, trying to force my sluggish brain into gear, and reluctantly rolled out of bed. "I'll be right there," I said. In the event, that turned out to be a bit of an optimistic forecast. By the time I'd thrown some clothes on, splashed some water on my face, and for once the Valhallan habit of washing in ice water didn't provoke a stream of blasphemy from me, which gives you some idea of how far I was gone, and got Jürgen to brew some double-strength recaf, nearly 20 minutes had passed. But I followed the directions I'd been given, picking my way carefully across the compound. The Rough Riders were still around somewhere, and entered a building I'd vaguely recalled being earmarked for the brigade-level communication specialists. This meant intelligence, of course, and I assumed I was about to be debriefed about the events of last night by some high-level spook. If I hadn't been so tired, I would probably have wondered about the number of high-ranking officers in the echoing marble corridors, and the increasing opulence of the furnishings in the succession of anterooms I was waved through by dress-uniformed troopers with gold-plated lasguns. But it all passed in a haze of irritation, and I never thought to question where I was and who had sent for me so peremptorily. "Commissar, please come in." The voice was familiar, but, dazed as I was still from lack of sleep, it took me a moment to recognize Donali. He smiled what looked like a genuine welcome, and motioned me towards a side table, where a fresh pot of Tanner tea steamed invitingly next to several large platters of food. I smiled in return, equally pleased to see him, although his night's adventures had obviously been at least as traumatic as my own. His expensive attire was now crumpled and stained, smelling of smoke and blood, and a dressing patch was stuck to his forehead. "This is an unexpected pleasure," I said, spooning a large portion of Salma Kedgeree onto a plate and pouring tea into the most capacious mug I could find. "I must admit I was rather concerned for your safety." "You weren't the only one." Donali fingered the dressing patch ruefully. "Things got a little hectic after you left." I took a seat at the conference table in the middle of the room. Several officers I didn't recognize were already there, along with other men and women in civilian dress. The latter I assumed to be Donali's colleagues, from the cut of their garments and their general air of bureaucratic prissiness. The only one who stuck out from the crowd was a woman slightly younger than the others, who wore an elegant green gown a couple of sizes too small for her, which showed rather too much décolletage for so early in the day, and who seemed curiously distracted, twitching and mumbling to herself from time to time before snapping upright and glaring round at the rest of us as though we'd somehow insulted her. I'd have taken her for an astropath if it weren't for the fact that she still had her eyes, which seemed to swim in and out of focus. Probably a psycho, then. I resolved to keep my mental barriers up, but, as I've remarked before, I've never had much trouble dissembling in front of them despite their curse. "Sorry I missed all the fun," I said, playing up to the audience's expectations of me, and started in on the food. I still had no idea why I was here, but I was a seasoned enough campaigner to make the most of the rations while they were on offer. While I plied my fork, I took the opportunity to study the officers' insignia, hoping for some clue as to their identities and why I was there, and found them a mixed bunch indeed. My gaze swept across a couple of majors, a colonel, and as I got my first good look at the man seated at the head of the table, I almost dropped my cutlery. This could only be Lord General Zyvan himself, the supreme commander of our little expedition. I hadn't seen any pictures of him, but his rank and campaign medals were clearly visible, and I'd heard enough descriptions of his steely blue eyes, actually slightly watery, and neatly trimmed beard, concealing the beginnings of a double chin, to have no doubt as to his identity. He was half turned away from me, discussing the contents of a data slate with an aide, and Donali was able to continue our conversation as he dropped into the seat beside me. "Don't be," he said. "You did us a far greater service last night than you could possibly have done by staying." "I'm glad to hear it," I said. "But you seem to have managed all right. The palace guard must be better soldiers than they look." "Hardly." He shook his head in disgust. "Half of those antique weapons of theirs malfunctioned, and the ones who did shoot couldn't hit the side of a starship. We barely held out until the PDF platoon arrived. If it hadn't been for Aurelius and his bodyguards picking off the ringleaders, the mob would have rolled right over us." "Aurelius. I took a welcome sip of the tea, and noticed that no one else seemed to be drinking it. Well, it's an acquired taste, I admit, but I'm one of the few non-Valhallans I know who likes the stuff. But the implication was flattering. They'd clearly provided it for my personal benefit. Whatever I'd been called here for, they wanted to keep me happy, which was fine by me. "You were right about him, obviously." "I was." Donali looked at me curiously, and again I felt he was playing some subtle diplomatic game, trying to gauge how much I'd surmised of what was going on behind the scenes, I supposed. I nodded, clearing the plate, and wondered if I could get away with going back for another portion. "You said there was more to him than met the eye," I reminded him. "So I did." He might have been about to say more, but Zyvan turned back to the conference table and cleared his throat. "Blast," I thought. "There goes my chance at a second helping of Kedgeree." There was still plenty of tea in the mug, though, so I sipped at it, regarding the room through a haze of pleasantly scented steam.
"Commissar," Zyvan addressed me directly, "thank you for joining us so promptly."
"My Lord General," I nodded a formal greeting. "If I'd known your chef was so talented, I would have been even less tardy," I added, enjoying the sudden intake of breath from around half those present. A commissar, of course, is outside the normal chain of command, so technically I didn't have to show deference to him or to anyone else, but most of us do our best not to remind the officers around us of the fact. As I like to tell my cadets these days, treat them with respect and they'll do the same to you. All frack, of course, but it greases the wheels. My status as a widely acknowledged hero allows me a bit more latitude, though, and I knew Zyvan had a reputation for bluntness himself, so I felt a bit of the bluff old soldier routine would go down well with him. I was right, too. He warmed to me at once, and we got on like a downhive bar brawl after that.
"I'll pass on your compliments," he said with a half-smile,
and the sycophants around the table decided they ought to like me, too.
"If you'd care to avail yourself further before we proceed?"
"Proceed with what, exactly?" I asked, moving to refill my plate. I'd forgotten to take my mug with me, so I took the teapot back to the table and topped it up there, keeping it beside me in case I wanted another refill. Partly, I admit, for the pleasure of upsetting some of the bootlickers again. "Anyone else while I'm up?"
"Thank you, no."
Zyvan waited until I'd sat down again before deciding he'd like some more recaf after all, and dispatching the most disapproving-looking of his aides to deal with it. As he did so, his eye caught mine, and the gleam of mischief in it was unmistakable. I decided I liked the Lord General.
"I've been reading your report," he said, once his recaf had arrived. "And I think I speak for everyone here when I say that I'm impressed."
A chorus of mumbled assent rippled around the table, not all of it grudging. Donali smiled warmly at me as he nodded, and I reflected that I seemed to have found a friend in the diplomatic corps, which could be very useful in future. The strange woman in green met my eyes for a moment.
"Choose your friends carefully,"
she said suddenly, her voice harsh with flattened vowels. I almost choked on my tea.
"I beg your pardon,"
I said, but her gaze was already unfocused again.
"There's too many out there," she said. "I can't hear them all."
One of the bureaucrats handed her an ornate silver box, a little smaller than her palm, and she scrabbled a couple of tablets out of it, swallowing them whole. After a moment, her attention seemed to sharpen again.
"You'll have to make allowances for Rakel," Donali murmured. "She's useful, but can be a little difficult."
"Evidently," I replied.
"Not quite the envoy I would have chosen to send to this little get-together," the diplomat went on. "But under the circumstances, I suppose they needed her talents the least at the moment."
"Who did?" I asked, but before he could reply, Zyvan called the meeting to order.
"Most of you know why we're here," he began with a sip at his recaf. "But for those of you who are new to these discussions,"
and he acknowledged me with a conspiratorial quirk of his mouth,
"let me reiterate. Our orders were to reclaim Gravelax for the Imperium, by force of arms if necessary."
The military officers harrumphed approvingly.
"However, the sheer size of the Tau military presence here changes the situation radically."
"We can still throw them out, my Lord General,"
one of the officers cut in.
"It would take longer than we'd anticipated, but
we would end up mired in a protracted campaign, maybe for years,"
Zyvan cut him off dismissively.
"And to be blunt, I doubt the planet is worth it."
"With respect, Lord General, that isn't your decision to make,"
the officer persisted.
"Our orders are
for me to interpret," Zyvan said.
The officer shut up, and the general turned to Donali.
"You still believe a diplomatic solution is possible?"
"I do,"
Donali nodded. "Although with the civil unrest persisting, it may prove more difficult, not to mention the matter of the ambassador's assassination."
"But the Tau are still willing to negotiate," Zyvan persisted.
"They are," Donali nodded again. "Thanks to Commissar Kane's resourcefulness last night, we still have a residue of good faith to draw on."
Everyone but Rakel, who seemed more interested in the underside of her recaf cup, looked approvingly at me.
"Which brings me to the assassination itself,"
Zyvan tried to attract the woman's attention.
"Rakel, has the Inquisitor made any progress in the investigation?"
"I suppose I should have expected it, especially after my suspicions about Aurelius the previous night, but I'd still been half inclined to dismiss them as the result of Devas and his drunken fantasies getting lodged somewhere in my brain." I stared at Donali.
"You knew about this?"
I murmured.
"I suspected," he replied, sotto voce. "But I didn't know for sure until Rakel turned up this morning with a message bearing the Inquisitorial seal."
"What did it say?" I whispered, ignoring the young psyker's attempts to reply. Donali shrugged.
"How should I know? It was addressed to the Lord General."
"The investigation continues, yes!"
Rachel nodded eagerly, forcing herself to concentrate with a visible effort, her flat nasal voice grating against my sleep-deprived nerves.
You will be informed when the conspiracy is exposed.
She paused, cocking her head as though listening to something, and stood abruptly.
Have you got cake?
She wandered over to the food table to check.
I see.
Zyvan tried to look as though she'd made some kind of sense.
If I may, Lord General.
I spoke up, trying to sound confident.
I suspect that there may be a faction here with an interest in provoking conflict between us and the Tau. So Messire Donali informs me.
Zyvan seized the opportunity to return the meeting to business with barely concealed relief.
Which is the main reason I invited you to join us. Your reasoning appears sound.
No cake! No fracking cake!
Rachel muttered in the background, scuffling around the food table.
I can't eat that! It's too green!
Thank you. I acknowledged the compliment and tried to ignore her.
Does it extend as far as to who might be responsible? Zyvan asked.
I shook my head.
I'm a soldier, sir. Plots and intrigue aren't really my specialities, I shrugged. Perhaps the Inquisitor can enlighten us when his inquiries are complete. Perhaps.
Zyvan looked a little disappointed, no doubt hoping I could have helped him to second-guess the Inquisition. Rachel returned to her seat, clutching a cinnabun, which she proceeded to nibble at for the rest of the meeting. At least with her mouth full, she kept quiet.
The other reason I wanted to consult you, Commissar, is that you've met Governor Grice. What's your assessment of his understanding of military matters?
I shrugged.
About as good as his understanding of anything else, if I'm any judge. The man's an imbecile.
More indrawn breaths around the table, but Zyvan and Donali nodded their agreement.
I thought as much, the Lord General said, although you'll no doubt be gratified to hear that he was very impressed with you.
He was? I couldn't imagine why, until Donali spoke.
After all, you did save his life last night.
I suppose I did, I said. I hadn't really thought about it, which was perfectly true. I disarmed the Tau to save my own skin, and so much had happened since then it had driven almost everything else out of my mind. Luckily, this was exactly the sort of thing everyone expected me to say, so I had the unexpected pleasure of receiving a warm smile of approval from one of the most powerful men in this segmentum. Of course, that would come back to haunt me in time, which only goes to prove that no good deed ever goes unpunished.
From this point on, Zyvan took a personal interest in Kane's career, eventually appointing him to his personal staff. This in turn led to a number of life-threatening incidents which are recorded elsewhere in the archive.
Well, he's been thinking about you, Donali said. He wants to give you some sort of medal.
The Order of Merit of Gravelax, second class. In later years, Kane was to joke that if he'd let the Tau shoot Grice after all, the grateful populace would probably have given him the first-class decoration.
That may have to wait, Zyvan said. We've a more urgent problem to deal with right now.
He touched a control stud on the arm of his chair, and the surface of the table lit up from within, proving to be a hololithic display of a size and resolution I'd seldom seen before. If I'd realized, I'd have been a bit more careful with the teapot. I wiped the ring of beverage away with my handkerchief as the image flickered drunkenly in the air before me, finally steadying into decipherability as Zyvan leaned forward and banged the tabletop hard with a clenched fist. He must have spent considerable time with the tech priests, because it functioned perfectly after that, staying sharp and in focus more than half the time.
That's the city, I said, stating the obvious.
Rachel nodded, spraying crumbs across the image like block-sized meteors.
All the little people look like ants,
she said, resting her head on the tabletop. The scale was far too small to show individual people, of course, or vehicles, even ones the size of a bane blade. But she was bonkers, after all.
Scurry, 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 looking up when they should be looking down. You never know what's under your feet, but you should, because you could trip up and fall.
I ignored her, picking out the salient tactical information with the instinctive ease of years of practice. There's still fighting going on. I could see a handful of hotspots across the city. Haven't the Arbetes managed to restore order yet?
Up to a point, Zyvan shrugged. Most of the civilian rioters have either been arrested, shot, or got bored and gone home. The big problem now is the rebel PDF units.
Can't the loyalists sort them out? I asked. It seemed obvious from where we were sitting that the Zenoists were outnumbered, at least 3-1 in most cases. Zyvan looked disgusted.
You'd think so, but they're bogging down. Half of them are refusing to fire on their own comrades, and the rest might just as well not be bothering for all the good they're doing.
He hesitated.
So the governor has, in his infinite wisdom, petitioned the guard to go in and clean up his mess for him.
But you can't. Denali was aghast. If the guard mobilize in the city, the tower will too. You'll spark the very war we're trying to prevent.
That hadn't escaped my notice, Zyvan said dryly.
The man's a cretin, Denali was fuming. Can't he see the consequences of his actions?
He's panicking, I said. All he can see now is the prospect of the rebellion spreading. If the Zenoists in the general population join them, we're fracked, Denali said. Not quite.
Zyvan compressed his lips into a grim parody of a smile.
I can still play for time. Briefly. Can you use it to convince the Tau that any guard deployment in the city is no threat to them?
I can try, Denali said, without much enthusiasm. Zyvan nodded encouragingly.
I can't ask for more than that.
He turned to me.
Commissar, would you say that the Tau have reason to trust you?
Well, of course they didn't, but that wasn't what he wanted to hear, so I nodded judiciously.
More than most other Imperial officers, I suppose. I did save them a bit of a walk last night.
As I'd expected, my modest joking at my own expense went down well, fitting these idiots' idea of a hero. Zyvan looked pleased.
Good, he said, and turned back to Denali. You can inform the Tau that Commissar Kane will be overseeing the operation personally. That might allay their concerns.
It just might. Denali looked a little happier at the prospect, which is more than I was, you can be sure. After all I'd been through the night before, the prospect of being sent back to the firing line again was agonizing. But I was supposed to be a hero, after all. So I sat there impassively sipping tea and wondered how I was going to get out of this one.
Chapter 8
Inquisitors? They're sneaky bastards. Useful, yes, even necessary, but I wouldn't buy a used air car from any of them. Arbitrator General Bex van Sturm. In the end, of course, I had no choice but to go along with it. The Lord General himself had picked me for this mission, so all I could do was hope for the best and prepare for the worst. Fortunately, Donali's negotiations with the Tau gave me a bit of breathing space, and I was able to devise a plan of action which gave everyone the impression of leading from the front while staying sufficiently far back from the firing line to appreciate the full tactical overview. Castine and Brocklaw had been fired with enthusiasm as soon as I took them into my confidence, certain that the Lord General's special interest in me boded well for the future of the regiment, so I was able to let them take the lead without really seeming to. Between us, we'd come up with a plan which actually looked like it might work, at least if the Blueys, as the troopers had begun to refer to the Tau, picking up on the local slang, could be persuaded not to take our incursion into the city in bad faith. That, of course, was a question only the Emperor could answer, and he was otherwise engaged, so I just thumbed my palm and got on with the things I could do something about.
A gesture used on many worlds in the segmentum to bring good luck or ward off misfortune. The thumb is pressed into the palm of the hand, leaving the fingers to form a stylized aquila wing.
Even then, I couldn't quite shake the suspicion that we were overlooking something important, that whatever shadowy cabal was trying to ignite a full-scale war on this worthless mudball wasn't about to give up that easily, but thinking about it only worried me, so I tried to forget it. For the life of me, I couldn't see what anyone could hope to gain by forcing a confrontation. And unless you know what your enemies are after, you can't devise any countermeasures to their plans. I don't mind admitting that it irked me a little. I'm used to my innate paranoia keeping me a jump ahead of most things, but even chaos cultists generally have an agenda of sorts, even if it's just kill everything on the planet, which makes itself obvious after a while. Still, that's what we have Inquisitors for. So I wished Aurelius the best of Imperial luck and gave up thinking about it in favour of the best way to give the rebellious PDF units a bloody nose. This was just as well, I suppose. If I'd had a clue as to what was really going on, I'd have lost even more sleep, believe me. They couldn't be making it easier for us if they tried, Brocklaw said with some satisfaction as he looked at the hololith. I'd prevailed on the Lord General to lend us the conference suite he'd summoned me to before, citing the need to coordinate the input of more than one regiment, and Brocklaw was as pleased with the tabletop display unit as a juvie with his first set of toy soldiers. I half expected to find it smuggled aboard the troop ship when we departed. He gestured at the disposition of the Xenoist units. What's that phrase you artillerists use? Clusterfrag? Close enough. Colonel Mostrew of the 12th Field Artillery nodded curtly, his ice-blue eyes, as always, regarding me with something akin to suspicion. Throughout my posting to his unit, he'd always tried to give me the benefit of the doubt, but of all the battery officers I've come across, he'd come closest to guessing the truth about Desolatia, and never quite seemed to trust me after that, which was extremely sensible of him when you think about it. Certainly he'd responded with almost indecent haste on the few occasions I'd been forced to call in a barrage close to my own position, but in turn, I'd preferred to think he was just doing his job as efficiently as possible. He hadn't changed a bit in the years since I'd seen him last, unlike the visible marks the passing of time had left in Devas. The Major was with him too, still limping slightly after our brawl with the Xenoist supporters a week or so ago, and grinned at me with the same unrestrained enthusiasm he always displayed. "It'll be like shooting fish in a barrel," he declared confidently. "For you, maybe," Castine said. "But we'll be where the fish can shoot back." The Xenoists were lightly armed, for the most part, with nothing much stronger in terms of firepower than missile launchers, so the artillery unit wouldn't have to worry about return fire, but unfortunately they'd had enough sense to dig in, for the most part in the area around the heights. That meant winkling the survivors of the barrage out, building by building, which would be hard, bloody work if things didn't go well. Fortunately, Castine and Brocklaw's experience of urban fighting was just what was needed here, and I hope the men and women of the 597th would find the PDF defectors easy meat after the Tyranids they'd faced on Karania. "We'll keep their heads down for you," Devas promised. "All you'll need to clean them up afterwards is a mop." Castine and Brocklaw exchanged glances, but let it go. Devas might have had only the vaguest idea of what city fighting entailed, but he did know his artillery, and I'd spent enough time with his unit to understand his confidence. The Xenoist defectors had gradually linked up as they pulled back to the heights, packing tighter and tighter into the network of boulevards and parkland around the mansions, until they might just as well have been standing there with a big target painted around their perimeter. "It's all a little too neat for me," I said. "You'd think they'd have the sense to disperse." "Amateurs," Mostrew's contempt was obvious. Like most senior guard officers, he had a low opinion of the majority of PDF regiments, although I'd come across a few in my time who could have given a guard unit a run for their money. In this case, though, his opinion seemed more than justified. A heavy barrage would take out the majority, I had no doubt. Of course, the survivors would be well dug in and hard to shift, especially with all that fresh rubble to burrow into, but I couldn't see there being too many of them. Certainly nothing the 597th couldn't handle in pretty short order. Even allowing for the defectors' lack of experience, though, it seemed remarkably stupid of them to offer so tempting a target. And the tingling sensation was back in my palms. I tried to concentrate on the briefing and not think about the undercurrents of conspiracy I was sure Aurelius was tracking down even as we sat here. I had hoped to set my mind at rest by interrogating the PDF idiots who'd shot down the Tau aircar and determining once and for all whether it had been a simple act of stupidity or part of a more sinister agenda. But despite my order to arrest them, the perpetrators had simply vanished, or joined the defectors, which raised even more questions I wasn't sure I wanted the answers to. "What do you make of this?" Brocklaw asked, studying the display more closely. I followed the line of his finger to where a platoon of loyalist PDF troopers had cordoned off a couple of blocks of an industrial zone near the old quarter and shrugged. The local boys afraid to get their fingers dirty. The icon at the centre of the cordon marked a hostile contact, but they didn't seem to be in any hurry to close the noose. Presumably some stragglers too late to join the exodus to the heights, I thought. That was followed by the sudden realization that I could use this little anomaly to my advantage. "I'll swing by and see if I can buck their ideas up," I said. "It's not far out of our way." And by the time I'd finished the extra piece of make-work I'd just found for myself, Castine and Brocklaw should have the Xenoist survivors pretty much dealt with. If all went well, most of the dust would have settled before I got anywhere near the firing line. It seemed my luck hadn't deserted me after all. "Are you sure, Commissar?" Castine was looking at me curiously, and that old expression was back in Mostru's eyes. "It doesn't seem all that important. Surely it can wait until we've dealt with the main force." "It probably can," I shrugged. "But the Lord General himself is trusting me to clean up this mess. I don't want a nucleus of rebellion left to deal with after we've broken the back of the conspiracy. I'd feel a lot happier if we knew for sure they weren't going to break out before we can get to them." "Good point," she nodded. I decided it was time to lighten the mood and smiled. "Besides," I said, "it's not as though any of you need your hands held. I think you know one end of a lasgun from another by now." Castine, Brocklaw and Devas laughed, and Mostru essayed a wintry grin. "I'd rather not divide our force, though," Castine added. "If we're going to mop up the bluey the Xenoist sympathizers, I want to keep our net tight." "Agreed," I said. "We'll stick to the timetable. I'll just peel off, put the fear of the Emperor into the PDF drones guarding the perimeter to make sure none of the rebels inside escape while we're busy, and catch up. I should be back with you before the fun begins." "I'd put money on it," Castine smiled. "I've seen the way Jürgen drives." She would have lost the bet, of course. I was going to make damn sure I got delayed sorting out the PDF rabble until after the shooting stopped. That was the plan, anyway. If I'd known what I was letting myself in for as a result of that little diversion, I'd have led the charge into the heights in a heartbeat. Denali finally contacted us about an hour after noon, saying the Tau weren't exactly happy at the prospect of Imperial Guard units running rampant in the city. But so long as I was there to keep an eye on things, and we stuck to the plan they'd been shown, they'd let us get on with it without interference. Of course, the language was a bit more diplomatic than that, but you get the gist. I was also aware of the subtext, even before Denali helpfully spelled it out for me, that if they got so much as a sniff of treachery, they'd be on our backs with guns blazing before you could say foobar. So, as you can imagine, I was feeling somewhat under pressure, as the force of which I was titular head left our compound and entered the city, so much so that I wasn't even able to enjoy the unique position I found myself in.
Kane is mistaken in his assumption that his position was unique. It was by no means unprecedented for a commissar to be given direct command of an ad hoc task force when circumstances demanded it, although it was, and is, an extremely rare occurrence. In fact, there is at least one instance on record of a commissar being given overall command of an entire regiment for a period of several years, albeit with the dual rank of colonel to facilitate the paperwork.
As I said before, I'd had the sense to let Castine and Brocklaw make the tactical decisions, as their experience of city fighting was rather more practical than mine. So I was pretty confident that we had the right mix of resources to achieve our goal. Reasoning that the ground would be pretty chewed up by the time the artillery had finished, which I could attest to from personal experience after my time with the 12th, they'd suggested going in on foot with a troop of sentinels for heavy fire support. That sounded good to me, as the walkers would have a devastating psychological effect on the shell-shocked survivors of the barrage, or at least I hoped so. Taking the Chimeras in close was right out. Their tracks would be shredded in moments once they entered the rubble. But if they held back on the perimeter after debarking their troopers, their heavy bolters would certainly encourage any rebels still inclined to make a fight of it to keep their heads down. We debated about bringing in an armoured unit too, but decided against it. A couple of Lehman Russes would have made little difference against dug-in infantry, especially after Mostru's Earthshakers had finished doing their stuff. And it would have meant bringing another regiment into the operation. Given the delicacy of the situation, I wanted to keep the opportunities for fouling things up to a minimum. And my paranoia was tingling again, warning me not to spread our plans any further than we needed to. Besides, tanks would have slowed us down, and the key to this operation was speed, especially if I wanted it to be all but over by the time I arrived. The harder and faster you go in, the better. I concluded my briefing speech, breaking off to glare at Sula, who'd whispered something at her neighbour and giggled. Are there any questions? There weren't, which meant the plan was either brilliant or so fatally flawed no one could spot it. So I made one of the standard encouraging speeches I'd been trotting out by rote since the head of my old scholar had presented me with my scarlet sash and told me to get lost, and dismiss the sergeants and officers who started to trickle back to their squads. I caught Lustig's eye, and he grinned at me. I'd made sure his squad were assigned to the centre of the battle line, as I thought getting stuck into a proper stand-up fight would be good for their morale. Gunning down the PDF loyalists had left a sour taste in their mouths, I knew, although they were good enough soldiers to have appreciated the reasons for it. A couple had been to talk to the chaplain, but all in all they'd held up remarkably well. I knew if they were left with time to brood on it, though, their morale might start to suffer, so it seemed prudent to take steps quickly before the rot had a chance to spread. "I take it you approve, Sergeant," I said. One of the most important things I'd found over the years, and which I try to instill in my cadets these days, is that you should always take the time to talk to the troopers as individuals. You'll never make friends of them, except possibly a couple of the officers if you're lucky, and you'll never get the job done if you try. But they'll follow you a damn sight more readily if they think you care about them. And what's far more important, at least to me, is that if they start to think of you as one of their own, they'll watch your back when the shooting starts. I've lost count of the number of times one of the grunts around me has taken out a Xena or a traitor who would have put a round in my back before I even noticed them. And I've returned the favour too, which is why I'm well into my second century, while the graveyards are full of by-the-book commissars who relied on intimidation to get the job done. "It's a good plan, sir," Lustig nodded. "My boys and girls won't let you down." "I'm sure of that," I said. "I wouldn't have asked for them otherwise." A faint flush of pride worked its way up past his jawline. "I'll tell them you said that, sir." "Please do." I returned his salute and looked around for Jürgen as Lustig strode off, his shoulders set. There shouldn't be any morale problems with his squad now, I thought. My aide was nowhere to be seen, so I walked towards the door, past the row of chairs where more than a dozen officers and non-coms had been sitting a few moments before. If I knew Jürgen, he'd be in the vehicle park conscientiously checking over our salamander. "Commissar?" I turned, momentarily startled by the voice at my elbow. Sula was still seated, her face flushed with uncharacteristic nervousness. She juggled the briefing slate in her lap. "You have a question, Lieutenant?" I asked, keeping my voice neutral. She nodded rapidly, swallowing a couple of times. "Not exactly. Sort of." She stood, the top of her head level with my eyes, and tilted it back slightly to speak directly to me. "I just wanted to say..." She hesitated again, then blurted it out in a rush. "I know you haven't formed a very high opinion of me since you joined us, but I appreciate you giving me a chance. You won't regret it, I promise you." "I'm sure I won't," I smiled, a warm expression calculated to boost her confidence. "Your platoon was my first choice for this mission, because I know they can get the job done." In truth, it was Lustig's squad I wanted, for the reasons I've already gone into, and the rest of the platoon just came along with them. But she didn't have to know that. Integrating the two old regiments into a new unit has been tough on everyone, especially those of you who were thrust into positions of responsibility you weren't prepared for. I think you've coped admirably." "Thank you, Commissar." She coloured visibly and trotted out with a slightly uncoordinated salute. "Well, that was an unexpected bonus. If I was any judge, she'd be so keen to justify my non-existent confidence in her that she wouldn't be making any more trouble, at least for a while. Despite the prospect of imminent combat, there was a definite spring in my step as I went to find Jürgen." The first part of the plan went like clockwork. We formed up in the main vehicle park, two full platoons, which I thought would be enough for the job, plus the sentinels, which hissed and clanked their way over the rockcrete to join us like vast robotic chickens. And if you think they look ungainly, try hitching a lift on one sometime. I've been in boats in a storm and felt less motion sick. Mind you, when the alternative is being ripped apart by orcs, I'll take an upset stomach any time. If you think that sounds a little on the puny side, remember, the Xenoists only numbered about a dozen squads themselves, so we had them pretty well outnumbered even so, and given the delicacy of the diplomatic situation, I didn't want to go in with any more troopers than we needed. Besides, I was counting on the artillery barrage to take most of them out, so the firepower we had seemed more than enough for mopping up with. And before you ask, yes, I suppose dropping shells on a part of the city we'd been sent to protect did seem a little paradoxical to us at the time, but it was all a question of expediency. To my way of thinking, anyone still in the target area was there by choice, and any civilians who hadn't fled there were either traitors themselves or so stupid we were doing future generations a favour by removing them from the gene pool. I mounted the command salamander Jürgen had procured and looked out over our expeditionary force, feeling a surge of pride in spite of my obvious trepidation. The infantry squads were mounted in chimeras, the two platoon command ones standing out from the rest by virtue of the vox antennae that clustered their upper surfaces. Sula's head and shoulders protruded from the top hatch of hers, a pair of earphones protecting her from the engine noise. Seeing me look in her direction, she raised the mic in her hand. "Third platoon ready," she reported. "Fifth platoon ready," her opposite number, Lieutenant Farrell, echoed her words. A dogged, somewhat unimaginative commander, he nonetheless had the respect and confidence of his troopers, largely due to a dry sense of humour and an earnest concern for their welfare, which meant he was unlikely to press too hard if they ran into stiff resistance. I'd selected him precisely because of this, knowing he'd wait for the sentinels to back him up if things got sticky, instead of throwing his troopers' lives away taking stupid risks. Some casualties were inevitable, of course, but I wanted to keep them to a minimum. If the regiment's first clash of arms resulted in an easy victory, it would boost their confidence and consolidate morale, whereas a high body count could easily undo all the hard work we'd done getting them back into fighting trim. "All squadrons ready." That was Captain Chambers, head of the Sentinel troop. We had all three squadrons with us, which gave us a total of 9 walkers. Considerable overkill, given the quality of the resistance we were expecting, but there's nothing like overwhelming fire superiority to give you a sense of self-confidence. "Confirm." Brocklaw's voice joined the others in my combead. He was in another salamander, which, like mine, had been fitted out as a command unit. I was more used to the lighter, faster scout variant, which was always my vehicle of choice. I prefer to be able to outrun trouble if I have to. But under the circumstances, I wanted to be able to keep a close eye on things. Besides, the command version had a heavier flamer fitted, which might come in handy in the brutal close-quarter fighting I expected through the rubble of the heights. Which reminded me. "Artillery units, commence firing," I said. A moment later, the ground beneath our treads started to tremble as Mostru's earthshakers began living up to their name. I swept my gaze around, tallying the assembled task force. 12 chimeras, 9 sentinels, and 2 salamanders. I drew my chainsword and gestured towards the gate. "Move out!" I ordered. Jürgen gunned the engine, and we lurched into motion. Inured to his robust driving style by years of familiarity, I kept my balance with little difficulty. Brocklaw's driver moved smoothly in behind us, and I could see his head and shoulders in the open rear compartment. He caught my eye and waved. Castine, I knew, would dearly have loved to take command herself, but had stepped down in favour of her subordinate. After all, he too deserved a chance to prove his mettle, and technically the operation was too small to be overseen by someone of her rank anyway. I was pleased she'd given way without prompting, though, and I could tell Brocklaw appreciated it. It was another example of the way the regiment was beginning to function as it was supposed to. Castine was there to see us off, though, along with everyone else who didn't have pressing duties to attend to, or who thought they might get away with skiving off for a few minutes. A cheer went up from our comrades, which for a moment managed to make itself heard above the roar of engines, the din of the sentinels, and the rolling thunderclaps of the earthshakers. As we hit the streets, the city was in turmoil. We'd kept our plan secret, of course, so none of the natives had a clue what was going on. They scattered in front of us like frightened sump rats, and Jürgen gunned the engine as though it were capable of the speeds he usually drove at. Ahead of us, a plume of dust and smoke marked our destination. I flipped Vox channels to the tactical net. The Loyalist PDF units were being told to stand down and let us through, which came as a relief. Although ill-disciplined rabble that they were, many were arguing or demanding to know what was going on.
Major, I switched back. It's all yours for the moment. Try to save a couple for me, eh?
I'll do my best. Brocklaw waved as Jürgen peeled us away from the rest of the convoy, mowing down a couple of ornamental shrubs and a litter basket as we swung off the broad boulevard into a narrower cross street, which would take us to the industrial area. The muffled crump of the shells detonating was audible now, the shriek and whine of their passage presaging each explosion, and the noise cleared the street for us far more effectively than any Arbetes siren could have done. After a few moments and several lurching turns any driver but Jürgen would probably have flipped us over attempting to execute, the buildings around us were unmistakably industrial in nature. Still, that emperor-forsaken Zenoist-style architecture, admittedly, but sufficiently grubby for their purpose to be obvious.
Brocklaw to command. The Major's voice was calm and competent. Cease barrage, we're in position.
I was glad to hear it. I hadn't even begun my make-work errand yet, and he was already on the verge of clearing the traitors out. Jürgen began to slow the salamander, and with a sense of déjà vu, I could see a PDF officer stepping out in front of us, his hand raised. Manufactoria rose all around us, tall enough to shadow the streets, but apart from the man in uniform, there was no sign of life. That struck me as strange, as the work shifts should still have been in full swing.
Commissar, Jürgen said, his voice uncertain. Can you hear firing?
As the engine idled down, I realized he was right. For a moment I found myself wondering at the acoustics, assuming that what I was hearing must be echoes of the firefight up in the heights, which a series of crisp exchanges in my combi told me had already broken out. Then I realized it was coming from somewhere ahead of us, inside the line of the PDF cordon marked on the map slate in front of me.
What's going on? I asked, glaring down at the officer. He looked a little panicky.
I'm not sure, sir. We had orders to hold, but there's dozens of them. Have you brought reinforcements?
I'm afraid we're it, I said, playing for time.
Who are you holding against?
I don't know. We were pulled out of barracks last night and told to cordon off the area.
He didn't seem any older than the officer I'd shot, I noticed with a sudden flare of apprehension, and the rapid tumble of his words told me he was on the verge of panic. Whatever I'd blundered into was heading for the sump, that much was obvious, and I cursed my luck, but it was too late to back out now.
We were just told to secure the area until the Inquisitor's party got back.
Merciful Emperor, this was just getting better and better. Clearly whatever stones Aurelius had been turning over had revealed more than the shadowy conspirators he was chasing were happy with, and they were determined to make sure no one lived to pass on their secrets.
Did he say what he was after down here? I asked,
and the officer shook his head.
I didn't speak to any of them, only the captain did, and he's dead now.
His voice began to rise, hysteria bubbling below the surface. I jumped down to stand beside him, feeling the rockcrete jar beneath my boot heels, and tried to project all the reassurance and authority I could.
Then I take it you're the officer in charge, Lieutenant.
That got through to him.
He nodded, a short, myoclonic twitch. So report. Where did they go? When? How many? What can you tell me?
His jaw worked for a moment, as though he were trying to force it to function. Gunfire and screams continued to echo between the buildings.
There's a warehouse, back there.
He pointed to one of the structures. A lasbolt cracked from one of the upper windows, passing between our heads, and struck the side of the salamander. I ducked, pulling him down to safety, while Jürgen rotated the sturdy little vehicle on its tracks to bring the hull-mounted heavy bolter in line. It roared in response, gouging away part of the wall and reducing the sniper to an unpleasant stain.
Thank you, Jürgen.
I returned my attention to the young officer.
And the Inquisitor went in there?
They all did, just before dawn. We were told to let no one in or out until they came back. That would have been about 10.5 hours ago, by my reckoning. And something told me Aurelius wouldn't be returning any time soon.
How many of them were there? I asked.
He thought for a moment.
I saw 6, he said at last. 4 men and 2 women. One of them seemed a bit peculiar.
That would be Rakel, the Psyker, I assumed.
What about the hostiles? I prompted him.
He shook his head. They're everywhere, dozens of them. His head twitched nervously from side to side as he tried to keep the entire street in view.
Where? Inside the warehouse?
Mostly. He stood up, about to flee, and another Lazbot caught him in the shoulder. He fell back, shrieking like a child.
You'll be fine,
I told him after a cursory glance at the injury. One thing you can say for being shot by a Lazbolt is that they cauterize the wound they cause, so at least you won't bleed to death from a glancing hit, a fact that has saved my own miserable life on a couple of occasions. I looked back down the street, trying to spot where the fire had come from, and caught sight of some movement behind a pile of shipping crates. I pointed.
Ours or theirs?
I don't know. Emperor's blood, it hurts.
It'll hurt a damn sight more in a moment if you don't stop fracking me around, I shouted suddenly. Your men are dying out there. If you can't start behaving like an officer and help me save them, I'll finish you off myself.
That was the last thing I was going to do, of course. The way he was yelling, he'd draw the enemy fire off me like a champion when we moved, but it did the trick. I could see the coin drop behind his eyes as he suddenly remembered what had happened to the last PDF unit to get in the way of a commissar.
They're all civilians, he gasped out after a moment. Anyone in a uniform is one of ours.
Thank you. I pulled him into the shadow of a dumpster. Keep your head down and you'll be fine. I scrambled back aboard the Salamander, grateful for the armor plate surrounding me.
Brocklaw to Kane, the Major's voice rang in my combead. Are you all right? We're getting some odd feedback off your frequency.
So far. I checked the flamer, finding it fully charged and ready to go.
Emperor bless Jürgen and his streak of thoroughness, I thought.
It seems our PDF boys weren't holding back after all.
Resistance is light here.
His voice was drowned out for a moment by the crack of ionizing air I associated with one of the Sentinel multilasers.
But we'll be a while yet.
Don't hurry on my account, I said.
The renegades could only have small arms, judging by the sounds I heard, and the Salamander's armor was thick enough to afford complete protection. I switched frequencies, searching for the PDF squad's internal tactical net, but found only static. I should have known better, of course, but old habits are hard to break.
Unlike the Imperial Guard units Kane was used to fighting with, most Planetary Defense Force troopers on Gravelax weren't equipped with personal combeads. This lack of contact between individuals outside line of sight of one another partially accounts for the relative lack of coordination within a squad, which most Guard veterans disparagingly attributed to poor levels of training and discipline. Of course, most PDF units were inferior to them in this regard in any case.
A few more Lazbolts from behind the crates confirmed the identities of the rebels lurking there, making a mess of our paintwork in the process, so I triggered the flamer, sending a gout of burning promethium down the alley. The results were impressive. The crates bursting into flame, and the rebels behind them got caught in the backwash. They burst into the open, their clothes and hair on fire, shrieking like the damned, and Jürgen cut them down with the bolter. Their bodies exploded under the impact, spraying the walls of the building with burning debris, and I was incongruously reminded of fireworks.
"Let's finish this," I said, and my aide gunned the engine, rolling us forward over the pool of burning promethium which now carpeted the alleyway. As I glanced behind us, the PDF officer was gazing at the devastation we'd wrought, his eyes wide with shock. The alley opened out into a cross street, the wall of the warehouse forming one side of it, stretching away in front of us in both directions. The distinctive crack of lasgun fire continued to echo through the roads around it, and as our field of vision widened, I could see the sparks of muzzle flashes inside the building, and the puff of vaporizing rockcrete where other bolts were impacting around the upper windows. Shadowy figures were visible inside, snapping off shots before ducking back, and I could make out little of them, just that, as the wounded lieutenant had said, they were all in civilian clothes. They were a mixed bunch, too. I caught a glimpse of velvet and the crest of one of the merchant's guilds, and someone who looked like a pastry cook before I swept the flamer over the whole facade. The results were spectacular. The firing stopped at once, the wood of the window frames igniting with a roar, and a few short-lived screams cut the air.
"That ought to keep their heads down," Jürgen said with satisfaction, sending a burst of bolts after the promethium to make sure of the fact.
Thick black smoke continued to pour from the building, and a ragged cheer mingled with the roar of the flames.
I turned to see a wary group of PDF troopers emerging from the buildings opposite the warehouse, or whatever cover they'd been able to find among the parked trucks and other detritus of the street. A few ragged shots continued to echo between the buildings, indicating that not all the traitors had been incinerated, but their sporadic nature spoke of a panic-stricken retreat which was running into the troopers on the other side of the cordon. The plume of thick black smoke must have been visible from where they were by now, and they were evidently taking heart from the sight. I jumped down from the salamander.
"Sergeant Crassus, 49th Gravelaxian PDF."
A tall, grey-haired man snapped a salute, but kept his eyes on the street, the first PDF trooper I'd seen since I arrived on planet who actually seemed to know what he was doing. I returned it smartly.
"Commissar Kane, attached to the 597th Valhallan."
Once again, I had the quiet satisfaction of noting that my name had been recognised, the low murmur of voices among the troopers flattering my ego with its awestruck tone.
"We're grateful for your assistance," Crassus said. "Did the Inquisitor send for you?"
I shook my head.
"Just poking my nose in," I admitted. "I noticed your little sideshow on the tactical display and wondered what was going on."
Crassus shrugged.
"You'd have to ask one of the officers."
"I did." I pointed back up the alleyway where the Promethean pool had burned itself out, leaving a scorched patch of blackened rockcrete.
"Back there. He needs a medic, by the way."
"Ah." Crassus didn't seem surprised.
"I thought he'd done a runner, to be honest."
My lack of a reply seemed to confirm something for him, but after a moment he detailed one of the troopers to take a medkit and see to the lieutenant.
"You seem to be standing up to combat better than most of the PDF," I said.
Crassus shrugged.
"I'm a fast learner. Besides, I'm used to looking after myself."
Taking in his physique and his air of watchfulness, I didn't doubt it.
"I was in the Arbetes before I joined up."
"That seems like an odd career move," I said. His jaw tightened for a moment.
"Office politics," he said curtly.
I nodded sympathetically.
"It's the same in the commissariat," I told him.
This is another prime example of Kane's manipulative streak, in which he invites confidence by pretending to have shared the experiences of others. Though there are, of course, divisions within the commissariat over matters of doctrine and procedure, they can hardly be described as anything so trivial as office politics. They are also, let us note, considerably less fratricidal than similar disagreements among fellow inquisitors.
But before we could exchange any more words, a loud crack from behind us presaged the collapse of one of the upper stories of the burning warehouse.
"Better pull your men back," I told him. "That's going to go any minute."
"I think you're right." He summoned the squad vox operator, relayed the instruction, and led his men up the alley at a rapid trot. I turned to look at the warehouse again. It was well ablaze by now, and pieces of debris were starting to drop from the roof and outer walls. I scrambled back aboard the salamander while Jürgen gunned the engine and began to reverse us to safety. Abruptly, I became aware of the sound of small arms fire echoing from inside the building, audible even over the pop and crackle of the flames.
"Crassus,"
I voxed, chafing at the necessity of relaying messages through his squad vox operator. "Are any of your men inside the building?" He had just begun to reply when the link went dead, overridden by a message on a higher priority command channel. I'd done the same thing enough times to recognize what was happening, but it had been a long time since I'd been the one cut out. Still, I supposed it showed Aurelius was still alive at any rate, and I'd heard enough of the reply to be reassured that I hadn't accidentally killed any more loyal subjects of the Emperor. That was a relief, as I was still slogging through the paperwork on the last lot of collateral damage I'd inflicted on the PDF. I'd just decided that the firing I'd heard was overheated ammo cooking off, or Xenoist traitors deciding they'd rather shoot themselves than be burned to death, when Crassus was back on my combeat.
"Commissar, the Inquisitor's team are pinned down inside the warehouse. They want immediate extraction."
Well, what they want and what they'll get are two different things, I thought. Venturing into that inferno would be suicide. Let Crassus try if he wanted, but it looked to me as though Aurelius and his cohorts were about to report to the Emperor in person, and there was damn all any of us could do about it. Then a truly horrifying thought struck me. I'd been the one who set fire to the building. If the Inquisition thought I'd been responsible for the death of one of their own, and had just stood by and let him burn without even trying to rescue him, I'd be a dead man, if I was lucky. I dithered for a fraction of a second, which seemed like eternity, and came to a decision.
Stay back, we'll handle it, I told Crassus, and leaned over the driver's compartment to call to Jürgen. Take us in, I shouted. As usual, where anyone else might have hesitated or argued, he simply followed orders without thinking. The salamander lurched forwards, accelerating towards the blazing building as rapidly as it could. There, those loading doors, I pointed, but my faithful aide had already seen them, and a hail of bolter shells ripped them to shreds an instant before we hit. We bounced into the shadowy interior of the warehouse, billows of smoke shrouding everything, pieces of tattered door spraying from under our tracks. I coughed, tore off my sash, and tied it around my face. It didn't do a lot of good, to be honest, but my lungs felt a lot less choked than before. Lasbolt started striking the front armor of the vehicle, which at least gave us a clue as to where the enemy was, and Jürgen was about to reply with the heavy bolter again when I forestalled him. Wait, I said. You might hit the Inquisitor. That would have been the crowning irony. Instead, he swung us over to one side, slamming into a pile of stacked crates and bringing them crashing down. Sudden screams were abruptly cut off. I twisted my head frantically, trying to orientate us, and the whole vast space was suddenly lit in vivid orange as the roof whooshed into flame. Frack this, I said, on the verge of ordering Jürgen to withdraw. Then I caught sight of a small knot of figures hurrying towards us. I pointed, and Jürgen swung the salamander round, stopping us almost dead. There were five of them, running for their lives, with an indeterminate number of shadowy figures in pursuit. Aurelius I recognized at once, turning as he ran to loose off a volley from his bolt pistol. A couple of the pursuers fell, but Lasbolt continued to impact around the Inquisitor and his retinue. A heavily muscled man I recognized as one of his bodyguards from the governor's party was firing too, but went down hard as one of the Lasbolts caught the back of his head. Aurelius hesitated for a moment, but even from where I was standing, it was obvious the fellow had been dead before he hit the floor. The rest of his party were in real trouble, so despite my natural reservations about making myself a more obvious target, I clambered up to the pintle-mounted bolter I'd made sure was installed. Not every salamander has them, but I've been grateful enough for their presence in the past to insist on having one available if at all possible. And I blessed that foresight now as I took advantage of the extra height the vehicle afforded me to fire over the heads of the inquisitorial party and strike home against their pursuers. A gratifying number went down or scattered, but too many carried on firing. I'd expected them to start shooting at me, but to my relief they continued to concentrate their fire on the fleeing figures before them. The scribe I'd seen with Aurelius was out in front, long white beard flapping as he ran with surprising dexterity for a man of his age. It was only after I saw him take a lasbolt to the leg, which sparked but continued to function, that I realized his lower limbs were augmetic. Behind him were two women. Rachel, whose green dress was now heavily stained with blood, apparently from a chest wound, but who was still babbling nonsense without appearing to inhale, and another who held her up. She was swathed in a hooded cloak of the deepest black I'd ever seen, which seemed to swallow the light that fell on it, blurring her outline. I saw her flinch as a lasbolt scorched the material, but she kept coming, supporting the gibbering psyker with surprising strength. I hosed down their pursuers again, hoping to throw off their aim at least, but for everyone I felled, another seemed to replace it, moving with an eerie precision which seemed somehow familiar. There was no time to worry about it now, though. I reached down to grasp the fingers of the old scribe, which to my total lack of surprise were also augmetics, and haul him aboard. "Much obliged," he said, dropping into the crew compartment and glancing around with evident interest. "An Imperial Guard salamander. Good solid piece of kit, manufactured on Triplex Val, unless I miss my guess." I left him to gather whatever wits he had and turned to the others. "Jürgen," I shouted, "help the women." Aurelius took a lasbolt to the shoulder, dropping his handgun. I wasn't about to lose him now, not after going through all this, so I jumped down, drawing my las pistol, and went to help him up. "Commissar Kane?" He looked slightly confused until I remembered my makeshift smoke mask and pulled it down. It wasn't doing a damn bit of good now, anyway. The whole building around us was ablaze, the heat terrific, and I suddenly remembered the promethium tanks of the heavy flamer aboard the salamander. Well, it was too late to worry about that now. "What are you doing here?" "I heard you needed a lift," I said, hauling him to his feet, and aiming a couple of speculative shots in the vague direction of the enemy. I dragged him back to the vehicle, where Jürgen was doing his best to help the women, but Rachel wasn't exactly cooperating.
She seemed terrified of him, struggling against her companion's grip in an effort to get away.
"He's nothing! Nothing!" she shrieked,
which seemed a little harsh to me. All right, he wasn't the most prepossessing trooper in the guard, but once you got past the smell and the interesting collection of skin diseases, he had his good points. Then she convulsed suddenly and passed out, dribbling foam between her clenched teeth. I hustled Aurelius aboard, hefted Rakel's dead weight like a sack of tubers, and let the scribe take her. He lifted her easily with his augmetic limbs, and I climbed up myself beside the woman in black as Jürgen returned to the driver's compartment and gunned the engine.
"Jürgen, get us out of here!"
I yelled, and he opened the throttle fully. "With pleasure, Commissar." The salamander leapt forwards, braking for the shattered loading door we'd come in by, and clipped the frame as we passed through, gouging a shower of sparks from it. As we gained the street, the furnace heat seemed to drop away, although it was still hot enough to raise blisters from our paintwork. I sagged with relief, trembling with the reaction, still trying to comprehend what an insanely risky thing I'd done. As if to underline how close we'd come, the building collapsed behind us with a roar of tumbling masonry. Well, there's no point cheating death with an act of insane bravery if no one's in a position to praise you for it. So I voxed Crassus.
"Crassus," I said, "the Inquisitor's safe."
"So I am." The woman in black dropped her hood, revealing a face I'd thought about often in the last few days. With blonde hair and blue eyes, she was even more beautiful than I'd remembered, and the voice I'd last heard singing sentimental ballads still had the faint edge of huskiness that had made my heart skip. Amberly Vale gazed at me with what I took to be faint amusement as my jaw dropped open, an inquisitorial electu flashing into visibility in the palm of her hand. "Thank you, Commissar," she added, smiling sweetly.
Editorial note. Once again, it seems prudent to insert a little material from other sources here, as the Valhallan's expedition against the Xenoist defectors was to have unexpected repercussions. Cain, as we might expect, has little to say on the matter himself, as his attention was elsewhere. The first is extracted from the after-action report of Major Rupert Brocklaw, made on 593.931.M41, shortly after the engagement was successfully concluded.
After the preliminary bombardment ceased, both infantry platoons disembarked from their chimeras, which had been dispersed around the perimeter of the rebel-occupied zone in accordance with the previously determined deployments. 3rd Platoon was supported by 1st Sentinel Squadron on the left flank, 5th Platoon by 2nd Squadron on the right, leaving 3rd Squadron with the company command element as a mobile reserve. Resistance was light, as anticipated, and 5th Platoon rolled up their flank with little difficulty apart from a couple of heavy exchanges of fire with dug-in survivors of the bombardment. Lieutenant Farrell called in sentinel support for the two squads thus engaged, which committed our reserve squadron. The flamer-equipped sentinel in each group cleared out the entrenchments with little difficulty after the other two laid down suppressive fire from their multi-lasers to allow them to approach. On the left, things didn't run quite so smoothly, as 4th Squad of 3rd Platoon came under crossfire from two enemy positions, pinning them in place. The flamer sentinel sent to assist was struck and disabled by a crack missile, forcing its fellows into a defensive posture which severely attenuated the effectiveness of their suppressive fire. At this point, Lieutenant Sula broke the deadlock by leading a command squad in a flank attack against one of the enemy positions, while 2nd Squad under Sergeant Lustig hit the other. By luck or good judgment, both were able to carry the positions almost simultaneously, allowing the remaining sentinels to close and 4th Squad to advance.
I am still undecided as to whether Lieutenant Sula's action was bold or reckless, but it was undeniably effective. Extracted from Like a Phoenix from the Flames, the founding of the 597th, by General Jennet Sula, retired, 097.M42.
Notwithstanding Commissar Kane's assurances that resistance would be light, as indeed was to prove the case, I felt more than a touch of apprehension as the barrage ceased, and Major Brocklaw gave the order to advance. Not at the prospect of combat itself, The pitiful handful of rebels we'd faced seeming little to fear after the Tyranid hordes we'd bested on Karania scant months before. But at the realization that my first real test as an officer was upon me, and the fact that one of the most renowned heroes in the Segmentum had reposed his trust in me, was an added burden which I felt ill-equipped to bear. All went well at first, however, with the squads in my platoon advancing swiftly to contact. My readers may well imagine the frustration I felt as I sat in my command chimera, listening to the vox chatter, reliant on the reports from my subordinates for a full tactical analysis, for until my unlooked-for promotion, I would have been among them, facing the Emperor's enemies head-on, as a soldier should. My impatience increased as it became clear that one of my squads, women I'd served alongside and men I was beginning to know and respect, was pinned down, taking casualties and unable to advance. As the sentinels, which should have relieved them, ran into trouble themselves, I could stand by no longer, regardless of my commissar's admonition to be cautious. Especially since, knowing his reputation, I was certain he would not have hesitated to put himself in danger for the good of his fellows, were he to find himself in a similar position. Calling on my troopers to follow me, and taking but a moment to switch the command channels to the combead in my ear, I jumped from the rear ramp, eager to join the fray. The sight which met my eyes was to give me pause. The elegant buildings and thoroughfares through which we'd driven were no more, their places taken by heaps of rubble, through which barely recognizable pieces of their original form could still, in places, be discerned. A thick pall of dust and smoke hung over everything, reducing the bright afternoon sun to a sullen grey, and for a moment I couldn't still the flicker of regret which rose unbidden in my breast. Even tainted by the alien as it had been, the architecture had been undeniably elegant. I had little time for reflection, however, as the crack of lasfire reminded me forcefully of the dire peril my soldiers were in, and with a cry of, "For the Emperor!" I led my doughty quartet to the rescue. A quick study of the tactical slate in the Chimera had shown me that I had an unengaged squad, sufficiently close to the most distant of the enemy positions to flank it, with a high probability of success, and after a few terse instructions to the sergeant leading it, this indeed was to prove to be the case. That left the nearest to us. We took them completely by surprise, a couple of frag rounds from our grenade launcher bursting among them and causing great dismay, before charging home to dispatch the survivors with pistols and chainswords. Cowards all, as those who oppose the Emperor invariably are, they broke and ran, exposing themselves to the vengeful fire of the squad they'd been pinning down, who were only too keen to even the score. I'm proud to say that of the team under my direct command, only one man was wounded, taking a las bolt to the leg as we charged, while none of the traitors escaped alive.
From which we may safely conclude that, whatever her martial abilities, Sula was no literary stylist.
Chapter 9.
Things are very seldom what they seem. In my experience, they're usually a damn sight worse. Inquisitor Titus Drake. It goes without saying that, given my profession, I'd had more than my fair share of unpleasant surprises. But to find that the woman I'd spent a pleasant social evening trying to impress with my half-formed speculations about events she was privy to, and, it must be admitted, had been quite smitten by, insofar as I've ever been susceptible to such things, was really an undercover inquisitor, came pretty close to the top of the list.
At the risk of appearing egotistical, I suspect he's protesting a little too strongly here.
And if that wasn't bad enough, the expression of tolerant amusement on her face at my utter stupefaction increased my discomfiture a thousandfold. But I thought, "Aurelius," I said, barely making sense even to myself.
Amberley laughed as the salamander hurtled through the streets back to the fortified compound where Zyvan had established the headquarters of our expeditionary force. Through the vox bead in my ear, I could hear the firefight in the heights continuing. Sula had apparently done something stupid, but we were winning comfortably with few enough casualties for things to be fine without any further interference from me. So I felt justified in ordering Jürgen to take us back to the staging area as quickly as possible. Rakel and Aurelius quite clearly needed medical attention, which gave me the perfect excuse, and I supposed it was my duty to see the Inquisitor safely on her way as quickly as possible. As it turned out, of course, I was to see a great deal more of her before we left Gravelax, and even that would be just the beginning of a long and eventful association which was to leave me in mortal peril on more occasions than I care to contemplate. Sometimes I wonder whether, if I'd had some premonition of who she really was the first time I saw her, I'd simply have left the room and avoided all the horrors to come in the ensuing decades. But I doubt it. Her company, on the rare occasions I was able to simply enjoy it for its own sake, more than made up for all the times I was left fleeing for my life or facing imminent painful death. Hard as that may be to understand, if you'd met her, you'd think the same, I'm sure.
Frankly, I doubted, but we certainly seemed more at ease in one another's company than either of us were used to with anyone else. Make of that what you will.
Aurelius? She braced herself as Jürgen swung us around a bend most other drivers would have thought too tight at half the speed. He helps me out on occasion. She smiled again. He seemed very impressed with you at the governor's party, by the way. Then he's an inquisitor too? I asked, my head still spinning. Amberley laughed like water over stones and shook her head. Good Emperor, no. He's a rogue trader. What in the warp made you think he's an inquisitor? Just something a friend said, I said, thinking that would be the last time I took Devis's word for anything. But I suppose, to be fair, he hadn't been all that wrong, as it turned out, and he hadn't been responsible for my own febrile imaginings. And the guy with the beard? I indicated the scribe, who was leaning over the lip of the driver's compartment, carrying on an enthusiastic conversation with Jürgen about the finer points of salamander maintenance. Caractacus Mott, my savant. She smiled fondly. A mine of information, some of it useful. The others I've met, I said. I indicated Aurelius, who had taken out a medkit and was tending to Rakel as best he could with a damaged arm. What's wrong with her? I'm not exactly sure, she replied, a thoughtful frown appearing for a moment on her face. That, I was later to discover, wasn't entirely true. She had her suspicions, but the truth about Jürgen wouldn't be confirmed for some time yet. To cut a long story short, we made it back to HQ without further incident and dispersed to our various duties. Amberley went off with the Medicaid to ensure that her friends were properly patched up, although, as I was to find out for myself on subsequent occasions, having an Inquisitor hovering in the corner doesn't exactly help them to concentrate on stemming the bleeding or whatever. I went off for a shower and a change of clothes, but was still smelling faintly of smoke when Brocklaw and the others returned in high spirits. "You did well, I hear," I congratulated him as he disembarked from his chimera. He nodded, still a little high from the adrenaline. "Cleared out the whole nest of them. Minimal casualties, too." He broke off to return Sula's salute. Her face was shining as though she'd just been out on a heavy date. "Well done, Lieutenant. That was a tough call." I just asked myself what the Commissar would have done, she said. At that point, I still didn't have a clue what either of them were talking about, but I assumed she'd distinguished herself in some way, so I tried to look pleased. It turned out later she'd pulled some damn fool stunt that had almost got her killed, but the troopers thought she was the hero of the hour, so it had all turned out for the best. Besides, it was the sort of thing I was assumed to have done myself, so I could hardly chew her out for it when the reports came in, could I? And then did the opposite, I hope, I said, then raised an eyebrow at her expression. That was a joke, Lieutenant. I'm sure whatever decision you made was the correct one under the circumstances. I hope so, she said, saluting again, then trotting off to check on the wounded from her platoon. Brocklaw watched her go with a thoughtful expression. Well, it worked anyway. Probably saved us a heap of casualties, too, but... He shrugged.
She'll probably do well in the end, if she doesn't get herself killed first.
Well, he was right there, of course. Although none of us could see at the time just quite how far she'd go. Like they say, it's always the ones you least expect.
For further details of Sula's illustrious career, see Dragan's biography Valhallan Valkyrie, a populist but accurate work, and similar to Like a Phoenix from the Flames, if you can tolerate her prose style.
After a few more words of little consequence, Brocklaw went off to report to Castine, and I went to look for a drink. I found it in a quiet booth at the back of the Eagle's Wing. The place was almost deserted, in an eerie contrast to my visit here with Divas, but I supposed it was still a bit too early in the evening for things to be lively. And anyway, the solitude fitted my mood. I'd noticed on my short walk to the bar that the streets were unusually quiet, too, and the few civilians I'd seen had seemed nervous, scuttling away from me as they caught sight of my uniform. Our show of strength against the rebels in the Heights had put everyone on edge, and, if anything, anti-imperial sentiment seemed to be gaining ground. I can't say I blamed them entirely, either. If I'd been a Grevelaxian, I'd probably be thinking that the Tau might be blue, bald and balmy, but at least they hadn't blown up part of the city. My opinion of Grice would have fallen even further for ordering us to intervene, if that were possible. As the Amasek started to kick in, I found myself brooding over the events of the afternoon. A hair's breadth escape from death does that to me. I start to contemplate my own mortality, and wonder what the hell I'm doing in a job where I'm liable to be killed pretty much all of the time. The answer, of course, is that I didn't have a choice. The assessors at the Scholar Progenium decided I was commissarial material, and that was that.
A decision which, on the face of it, seems remarkably perverse, given Kane's manifest character flaws. However, it's a decision his subsequent career triumphantly vindicates. We can only speculate how he would have fared if directed into some other branch of Imperial service, such as the Navy or, Emperor help us, the Arbetes.
I was just working myself into a perversely comforting mood of gloom and despondency when a shadow fell across me and a mellifluous voice asked, "Do you mind if I sit here?" Normally, I'm never averse to feminine company, as you'll know if you've read much of these memoirs, but right then all I wanted was to be left alone to contemplate the unfairness of the universe in a self-pitying haze of alcohol. However, it never pays to be impolite to an inquisitor, so I gestured to the seat across the table and masked my surprise as best I could. She'd found the time to change and freshen up too, I noticed, into a mist-grey gown which showed off her colouring to the best advantage. "Feel free," I gestured to the waitress, who looked vaguely disappointed as she delivered our order. "Two more, please." "Thank you." Amberley sipped delicately at the drink, a faint moue betraying her opinion of its quality, before replacing the glass on the tabletop and regarding me quizzically. I tried to pull away from her depthless blue eyes, then decided I didn't really want to after all. "You're a remarkable man, Commissar."
"So I've been told." I waited a heartbeat before smiling, though I can't say I see it myself.
The corner of Amberley's mouth twitched with what looked like genuine amusement. "Oh yes, the modest hero routine. You've got that one off pat, no question."
She knocked back the rest of her drink in one and signalled for another, leaving me gaping like an idiot. Her smile widened.
"What's next? I'm just a humble soldier, or, trust me, I'm a servant of the Emperor?"
"I'm not quite sure what you're insinuating," I began, but she cut me off with a chuckle.
"Ooh, honest indignation. I haven't seen that one in a while."
She picked at the bowl of nuts on the table, some local variety I didn't recognize, and flashed a grin of pure mischief at me.
"Lighten up, Commissar. I'm only pulling your leg."
"Yes, right," I thought, "and letting me know you can see right through every little manipulative trick in my repertoire in the process." Something of this must have shown on my face because her eyes softened.
"You could just try being yourself, you know." The thought was terrifying.
I'd spent so long hiding behind masks, I was no longer sure there was a genuine Caiaphas underneath them anymore, just a quivering little bundle of self-interest.
and an even more terrifying thought hit me. She could tell what I was thinking. Everything I'd tried to conceal about my fraudulent reputation would be open to her, and the Inquisition, Emperor's bowels! Relax, I'm not a psyker, just very good at reading people. She watched me sag into my seat with relief, not even trying to conceal it, the faint amusement still dancing in the back of her eyes. Whatever you're afraid I'll find out is still safe, and it'll stay that way. Unless you give me a reason to start looking for it. I'll do my best not to, I promised, picking up my own drink with a shaky hand. I'm glad to hear it. Her smile was warm again, because I was hoping you could help me.
Help you with what? I asked, already sure I wasn't going to like the answer.
The conference suite was less crowded this time, although since two of the others present were Lord General Zyvan and an Inquisitor who was already making it perfectly clear that she was in charge here, it certainly seemed full enough to me. The only other person present was Mott, the elderly savant, who sat bright and alert, occasionally poking at the dent in his leg left by a hasty tech priest who hadn't quite finished patching him up when the summons to the meeting had arrived. "Thank you for joining us, Commissar." Amberley flashed me a smile which looked genuinely warm, although as an experienced manipulator myself, I wasn't quite sure how far I could trust it. Zyvan nodded a greeting, also pleased to see me.
"Hello again," Mott smiled, surprisingly clear brown eyes flickering behind his excess of beard. He evidently hadn't found the time to wash the smell of the fire out of his hair and robes, or simply didn't care. "You've caused us a great deal of inconvenience, young man. Although I suppose you weren't to know."
"Know what?" I asked, trying not to snap.
I grabbed a couple of sandwiches to try and mop up the alcohol I'd drunk, and got Jürgen to find me some recaf, but between the Amasek and the reaction from the day's adventures, my head was still buzzing. All in good time.
Amberley smiled indulgently at the wizened sage. Caractacus does tend to skip the dull bits given half a chance.
"When you get to my age, you don't have time to waste on them," he responded, smiling in return.
I realized that this was all part of an easy familiarity between them, which spoke volumes for the trust the Inquisitor placed in him, and the length of their association. He turned back to me.
"Which reminds me, thank you for coming to our assistance. It was most timely."
"My pleasure," I said.
"Then you have an extremely perverse idea of what constitutes fun. You should get out more."
Amberley shook her head and raised an eyebrow at me in an exaggerated mime of exasperation. "You just can't get the help these days," she said. I couldn't think of any adequate response to this, so I said nothing. I'd never had a really clear idea of what an Inquisitor was supposed to be like, although, like most people, I had a vague impression of some scary psychopath who slaughtered their way through the Emperor's enemies. Amberley, on the other hand, seemed to be the complete antithesis of this. She had her ruthless streak, of course, as I was to find out during our long association. But back then, the cheerful, slightly whimsical young woman with the strange sense of humour seemed about as far removed from the general preconception of a profession as it was possible to get. Zyvan cleared his throat.
Which was, of course, the whole point.
"Inquisitor, perhaps we could get to the matter at hand."
"Of course." She activated the hololith, thumbing it in just the right spot to bring the image into focus. "It goes without saying that everything you see and hear is completely confidential, Commissar."
"Of course," I nodded.
"Good. I'd hate to have to kill you." She smiled again, and I wondered if she was joking or not.
"These days, of course." I know she meant every word of it.
"In case you haven't been paying attention," she went on, "I'm an agent of the Ordo Xenos. You know what that means?"
"You deal with aliens?" I hazarded. Back then, I had only the vaguest idea that the Inquisition was divided into multiple Ordos with specific areas of interest and responsibility, but it was a pretty easy deduction to make. Amberley nodded approval.
"Exactly," she began.
"For the most part, anyway," Mott chimed in helpfully. "There was that chaos cult on Arcadia Secundus, and the heretics of Gore.
Thank you, Caractacus," she said, meaning shut the warp up. So he did.
As I was soon to discover, being a savant meant being obsessed with detail and trivia, and all the pedantry that went with it. Imagine the worst barroom know-it-all you ever met, who really does and is cursed with a Tourette-like compulsion to spill out everything relevant on any topic that comes up, and you're about halfway there. Although he could be incredibly annoying at times, I found him good company in his own way once I got to know him, especially as his gifts included an uncanny intuitive grasp of probability, which we put to good use in a number of gambling establishments over the years. Amberley pulled up a star chart on the hololith, which I recognised without too much difficulty, as it had been reproduced in far less detail in the briefing slate I'd skimmed through before we made planetfall. "The Damocles Gulf," I said, and she nodded. "We're here." She pointed out the Gravelax system, seemingly alone and isolated on the fringes of Imperial space. "Notice anything about the topography of the region?" "We're close to the Tau border," I said, playing for time as I studied the images. She wouldn't be alluding to anything that obvious, I was sure. Several of the neighbouring systems were tagged with blue icons, marking them as Tau-held worlds. In fact, they almost engulfed our present position, with only a thin chain of friendly yellow beacons connecting us to the welcoming haven of Imperial space. "Too close," I concluded finally. "If we had to fight a war here, our supply lines would be far too thin for comfort."
"Precisely," Zyvan nodded approval and indicated a couple of choke points. "They could cut us off here and here with no trouble at all. We'd be blockaded and swallowed up in months, while they could reinforce at their leisure from at least four systems."
"Which is why we're so desperate to avoid a full-scale war over this miserable mudball," Amberley said. "Keeping it would tie up our naval assets from at least three sectors just to secure our supply lines, and we'd be funneling Guard and Astartes units in from all over the segmentum. Putting it bluntly, it's not worth the effort." To say that I was astonished would be putting it mildly. It had been an article of faith for as long as I could remember that the sacred domains of His Majesty's Imperium should never be polluted by the alien, no matter the cost. And here was an Inquisitor, no less, and the Lord General himself apparently quite happy to let the Tau just walk in and have the place. Well, that was fine with me, of course, especially if it kept me out of the firing line, so I nodded judiciously. "I can sense a but coming," I said.
"Quite right,"
Zyvan nodded, clearly pleased by my astuteness.
"Just letting the little blue Grox lovers walk in and take the place isn't acceptable either. It would send entirely the wrong message to them. They're already popping up on worlds all over the sector and arming to keep them. If they take Gravelax without a fight, they'll think half the segmentum is up for grabs."
"But we could beat them in the long run," I said, trying not to picture the decades of grinding attrition that would ensue as the overwhelming might of the Imperium met the techno-sorcery of the Tau. It would be the biggest bloodbath since the Sabbat World Crusade. "We could, eventually," Amberley nodded soberly, "if they were the only threat we had to face." She widened the view, systems falling into the centre of the hololith, new ones coalescing at the fringes of the projection field. Several systems were tagged in red. I recognised one of them as Corania, and then, a moment later, I picked out the Desolacia system, where I'd first been blooded against a Tyranid horde over a decade before.
"In the last few years, Tyranid attacks have been increasing in this region of the galaxy," Zyvan said. "But you'd know all about that."
"I've seen a few," I admitted.
"There's a pattern," Mott butted in. "Still not clear, but definitely beginning to form."
In hindsight, these were clearly the precursors of Hive Fleet's Kraken and Leviathan, the bulk of which had still to be detected at this time.
"Our greatest fear is that they could be the harbingers of a new Hive Fleet," Amberley said soberly. I tried to envision such a thing, and shivered involuntarily. The hordes I'd encountered before had been weak, the scattered survivors of Hive Fleet Behemoth, which had been shattered centuries before, but still dangerous shards of poison in the body of the Imperium. Even attenuated as they were, they could still overwhelm a lightly defended world, growing in strength with each one they consumed. The prospect of facing a fresh fleet with almost limitless resources was, quite simply, terrifying.
"Then let's pray you're wrong," I said. Unfortunately, as we now know, she was right twice over, and the reality was far worse than even my craven imaginings.
Exactly.
Zyvan made the sign of the Aquila. But if she's not, those ships and men will be needed to defend the Imperium. And it's not just the Nids.
He trailed off as Amberley shot him a venomous look. Clearly I wasn't supposed to be let in on everything.
Necrons, I said, jumping to the obvious conclusion. I pointed at the tomb world I'd been lucky to escape from a couple of years before. Not the friendliest of Xenos, and cropping up more frequently of late, if these contact icons are anything to go by. I indicated a couple of others in the same purple script.
That would be pure speculation, Commissar, Amberley said, a clear warning tone entering her voice, but Mott nodded enthusiastically.
A 273% increase in probable Necron contact over the last century, he said. Only 28% fully confirmed, however.
That would be because the majority of contacts left no survivors, of course.
Be that as it may, Amberley said, the fact remains that the resources we would expend fighting a war for Gravilax are likely to be needed elsewhere, and if we're forced to use them now, we would be fatally weakened.
Which still begs the question of who would be insane enough to try to provoke such a war, and what they would hope to gain by it, I said, eager to show I was paying attention.
Precisely what the Inquisitor was sent here to find out, Zyvan assured me.
Not exactly. Amberley killed the hololith display, probably to stop me from making any more uncomfortable guesses about what might be lurking in the outer darkness. Our attention was drawn to the increase in Tau influence on Gravilax, and the activities of certain rogue traders who seemed to be profiting from it. I came to look into that and assess the loyalties of the Governor.
That's why you had Aurelius pressuring him for trade concessions, I said, the coin suddenly dropping.
You wanted to see if he had any influence with the Tau.
Quite right. She smiled at me, like a scholar tutor whose least promising pupil has just recited the entire catechism of abjuration.
You're really quite astute for a soldier.
And your decision?
Zyvan asked, carefully not taking offence at the remark.
I'm still considering it, she admitted. He's certainly weak, probably corrupt, and undeniably stupid. He's let the alien influence take root here far too deeply to be dislodged without considerable effort, but he's no longer our primary concern.
You mean the conspirators? I asked. Whoever's trying to provoke a war over this?
Precisely, she nodded, favouring me with another smile, which, perhaps due to wishful thinking, looked remarkably like praise. Another astute deduction on your part.
Do you have any clue as to their identities?
Zyvan asked. Amberley shook her head.
There's no shortage of enemies who would stand to gain from weakening the Imperial presence in this sector, she said, with a warning glance at Mott, who seemed on the verge of listing them. Not at least the Tau themselves. He subsided with visible disappointment.
But whoever it is undoubtedly working through the Xenoist faction here and the PDF units they control. Fortunately, the guards seem to have drawn their teeth without dragging the Tau into it, for which we can all be thankful.
Zyvan and I took the implied compliment without comment.
How is the investigation into the ambassador's murder going? I asked. If you find the assassin, you find the conspirators, don't you?
Probably, Amberley shook her head. But so far we don't have a suspect. The autopsy showed he was killed by an Imperial bolt pistol at close range, but we already knew that, and half the guests at the party were carrying one. Our best lead is still the Xenoist connection.
Or it was,
Mott chimed in with a censorial glare at me,
until this young man set fire to it.
I'm sorry, I gazed at him in confusion.
So you should be,
he said without rancour. Amberley sighed.
The local Arbetes have been keeping tabs on the most vocal Xenoist groups. One of them used to hold meetings at that warehouse, so we went to check it out.
And found a bit more than you bargained for, I chipped in helpfully. She nodded.
That we did. We found a way down to the Undercity.
Definite surprise there, Mott chipped in helpfully. Although given the amount of relatively new Tau-influenced architecture in the city as a whole, finding one wasn't totally unexpected.
I suppose I must seem naive, but up until this point it had never occurred to me that there wasn't an Undercity. Part and parcel of growing up in a hive, I suppose. You see,
Most imperial cities are millennia old, each generation building on the remains of the last, leaving a warren of service tunnels and abandoned rooms under the latest level of streets and buildings, often tens or even hundreds of meters thick. Mayo, being so sparsely populated in imperial terms, didn't have anything like so thick a layer beneath it, but I'd just taken it for granted that it was bound to have the same labyrinth of sewers and walkways below its citizens' feet as any other urban area I was familiar with. "Seems like a good place to plot sedition," I conceded.
"Ideal," Amberley agreed, "as we found to our cost." "We were ambushed," Mott said, "though not before determining that the tunnel system is extremely extensive."
"Ambushed by who?" Zyvon asked.
"Ah, well, that's the question." Amberley cocked her head quizzically. "Whoever they were well-armed and well-trained. We barely got out alive."
"Tomas and Jocelyn didn't,"
Mott reminded her, and her brow darkened for a moment.
"Their sacrifice will be remembered," she said in the reflex way people do when they don't really mean it. "They knew the risks."
"More PDF defectors?" Zyvon asked. I shook my head.
"I don't think so. My aide and I got a good look at several of them. They were definitely civilians."
"Or in civilian clothes," Mott suggested. "Not necessarily the same thing."
"In either case," Amberley said decisively, "we need more information, and there's only one place we can get it."
I began to develop a familiar sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach.
"The Undercity," Zyvon said.
The Inquisitor nodded.
"Precisely, which is why I require your assistance."
"Anything at all, of course," Zyvon spread his hands. "Although I don't quite see..."
"My retinue is out of action, Lord General, and I'm not stupid enough to undertake an expedition of this nature entirely alone."
"Well, anyone could see that."
"I'd like to request the use of some of your guard troopers."
"Well, of course," Zyvon nodded. "You can hardly rely on the loyalty of the local PDF."
"Exactly," she nodded again.
"How many do you want?" Zyvon asked. "A platoon? A company?"
Amberley shook her head. "No. We'll need to move fast and light. One fire team, and the Commissar to lead them." She turned those dazzling eyes on me again and smiled. "I'm sure a man of your formidable reputation will be up to the challenge."
"Oh, I wasn't. You can take my word for it. But I couldn't refuse a direct request from an Inquisitor, could I? Although if I'd known what I was getting into, I'd probably have given it a damn good try. So I nodded and tried to look confident. "You can rely on me," I said with all the sincerity I could fake. And from the grin which quirked the corner of her mouth, I could tell she wasn't fooled for a second.
"I'm glad to hear it," she said. "I gather your regiment has had a great deal of experience in city fighting, so I'm sure they'll be ideal."
"I'll ask for volunteers," I said, but she shook her head.
"No need." She skimmed a data slate over the tabletop to me. I stopped it, a premonitory tingle beginning in the palms of my hands.
"You've already assigned some."
I glanced at the list of names, already knowing, in the way you can see the avalanche start even before the rocks begin to slide, what I'd read there. Kelp, Trebek, Valade, Sorrel, and Hollenby. The five troopers on the planet I'd least trust to watch my back, unless it was to stick a bayonet in it. I lifted my head.
"Are you sure, Inquisitor? These troopers are hardly the most reliable,
but they are the most expendable." She grinned at me, the mischievous light back in her eyes. "And I'm sure you can keep them in line for me." It was official, then. This was a suicide mission. I swallowed, my mouth suddenly dry.
"You can count on it," I said,
wondering how in the name of the Emperor I was going to get out of this one.
Chapter 10.
Trust? Trust's got nothing to do with it. I just don't want them out of my sight. General Karras, after promising full access to his command bunker to the local PDF commanders on Vortovan.
"Are you sure about this, Commissar?" Custine asked, clearly as troubled by the prospect as I was.
She and Brocklaw had joined me in my office at my request, and I'd filled them in on as much of the assignment I'd been handed as Amberley would permit. I sighed deeply. "No, I'm not," I admitted. But the Inquisitor was quite insistent. "These are the troopers she wants." "Well, we'd better give them to her," Brocklaw said. "At least they'll be off our hands at last." Castine nodded, clearly cheered by the prospect. "That's true," she conceded. "Despite my best efforts to arrange their transfer to a penal legion, the Munitorium was proving as slow and obstructive as usual, and didn't seem the least bit inclined to send a ship all the way out here just to pick up a handful of cannon fodder. Normally, that wouldn't have been a problem. I'd simply have found space on the next outbound freighter or something, but Gravelax wasn't exactly the hub of the Segmentum. And even what little shipping there normally was had almost dried up as the political situation deteriorated. Even if the worst-case scenario I'd been shown on the Hololith didn't come to pass, it looked as though we were going to be stuck with the 5 defaulters until we returned to Imperial space, which was going to be months away at this rate. Which, in turn, had meant they were our responsibility for the foreseeable future. Which wasn't exactly what I'd had in mind when I cheated Pargita out of his firing squad back aboard the Righteous Wrath. "And on the plus side," Brocklaw went on cheerfully, "at least we won't be losing anyone we'll miss." He stopped suddenly, realized what he'd just said, and floundered in a way I would have found comical under any other circumstances. "Not you, Commissar, obviously. I mean, we would miss you, but I'm sure we won't. I have to, I mean, you'll be back." "I certainly intend to be," I said, with more confidence than I felt. I still hadn't been able to think of a plausible reason to wriggle out of the assignment, so I'd bowed to the inevitable and started trying to find ways of ensuring my own survival instead. None of the troopers could be trusted, that much was certain, but Amberley seemed confident enough, so my best bet was to stick close to her and hope she had a plan of some kind. On the other hand, chances were that Aurelius's luckless bodyguards had thought the same thing. Like most hivers, I was comfortable enough in a tunnel complex unless someone was actually shooting at me. So maybe the most prudent thing would be to get conveniently lost at the earliest opportunity and make my way back to the compound after a reasonable interval had passed. Then again, if I did that and Amberley survived, she wouldn't be terribly pleased with me, to say the least. And the prospect of hacking off an Inquisitor wasn't one to contemplate lightly. The upshot of all this was that I'd spent a largely sleepless night vacillating about my non-existent choices until sheer exhaustion had tumbled me into old nightmares of fleeing from gleaming metal killers down endless corridors, heaving grey masses of tyrannid chitin roaring in towards me like a tide of death, and a green-eyed seductress trying